My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing to prove.
Hi, this is Kim, and I'm here with Josh and Katie. We decided that we would add to the diversity of voices formats by having a conversation between three friends who've all of us have left the church within the past year. Just a little background. We will go ahead and tell a bit about our personal growing up quickly, and then we will go into more questions and answers about our life experiences in the church and leaving the church. Just a little bit of background is Josh and Katie are married, and they have a teenage daughter and a tween daughter, and their entire family have left the church. I am married to an active member, and I have two young children who are still attending church. So let's get started. Josh, do you want to start?
Sure, I'll start. So I actually was born into a family of, well, I'm the oldest, but there were five boys in my family. We started off in Utah, but at a certain point, my father moved for a job to Northern California, which is where I grew up. And by and large, my experience in the church was very positive. Mind you, I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, and there was a lot of activities like road shows and dances and all sorts of things. And the church was very active in Northern California. And I really appreciated sort of going to all of these events and participating, and I had a lot of great friends. My family was also very open about the diversity of the world. We did a lot of traveling. We were able to travel to Europe and Asia when I was a young kid. And I think we'll get back to that a little later on, but those experiences really opened up my eyes to how other people live. Although at the time, I definitely felt that I was unique and special because I had the truth, the true church. And I definitely, growing up, felt like there was a huge opportunity to be able to share that. I did grow up in a family that performed together. We were all musicians. And so we traveled a lot doing that, and so I did get to meet a lot of interesting people that way, and I often thought of that as a mission, an ongoing mission, when I was a kid. But overall, just a great great childhood, great family, no real issues growing up.
My name is Katie, and I am the middle child of a large Mormon family. My parents were converted to the church when my oldest brother was a baby, so they were originally raised Catholic, and I had a happy childhood. I can't say that I was raised much in the culture of the church. I grew up in the Midwest, and there just wasn't a whole lot to the whole culture, church culture there. It was just the Midwest culture, which I guess is kind of like church culture, and it's very close, and people are very kind and loving, and it's a big family, but it wasn't really church culture to me, so I didn't ever experience that until later in my life. In my teenage years, I can't ever say that I felt like I was a TBM, because really the church made sense to me on a very rational level. The kids that I grew up with were very involved in alcohol and drugs and sex. And for me, the church kept me out of that with the rules. And the rules made sense to me because I didn't want to follow the path that I saw a lot of kids follow. So for me, the church was a guideline for me to stay out of trouble more so than it was a spiritual place. So for me, it was good. It worked for me. And that was about it for my childhood.
Okay. And this is Kim again. I come from a family that is very strong believers. We have lots of pioneer ancestry and goes back a great deal on all sides of my family. I loved the church. I also was a child of the 70s and 80s, so church was fun. It was all I knew. I grew up in Utah, so everyone I knew, I had only a couple of friends that were not LDS. So it was just very much a part of my worldview, and it made sense, and I loved it. I had also that feeling of we're unique and special. And growing up, I didn't really question it at all. I loved it, and it worked for me. When I was 20, I'm just going to share a little bit of information. When I was 20, I had a brain tumor that kind of rocked my world a little bit and definitely had me explore different options. And the idea of facing my own death was there, and that definitely expanded my worldview. And after that, I started exploring different things as well. So that was kind of a shifting point. I know we're going to go into some of the discussion, but I think that's part of my growing up history, because I was still kind of a kid at 20. So there we go.
Well, why don't we talk about sort of some of the changes then that happened? So I'll go ahead and start. Sort of as a little bit of a backstory, when I was 12, I had the opportunity to go to France and to participate in a folk festival in France, where I met people from all over the world. And one of those people was a girl from Poland, and we became fast friends and pen friends. And I spent
the days before email.
That's right. And we used to write each other letters and send each other things. And mind you, this was before the wall had fallen, or the Berlin Wall. And so, you know, it was a fascinating back and forth between her and I. And I remember at one point writing a letter to President Monson, telling him how excited I was going to be when I could go to Poland on a mission and talk to her, tell her about the gospel, and baptize her. And I did get a letter back from President Monson, and it was a very kind letter. And I just always knew that I was going to get called to Poland, which I was. It was called to Poland. I don't think that it was very hard to get called to Poland, because I don't think most people were really that interested. Mind you, this was a year or two after they had just opened the mission in Warsaw. And again, I traveled before, so I'd been able to see the world, and I was just really excited about going. And as I look back on it now, I think that I was really more excited about traveling and being part of a new culture than I was about the mission per se. But, you know, at the time, too, I really believed. Just a couple of things I think were worth note. I'm a musician. I play the piano, and it's something that's always been an important part of church for me, and continued until we left. I used to play the piano at the MTC, and I would play the hymns and such during our sacrament meetings. And I would always kind of riff off of the general themes and kind of make it more exciting, because those meetings could be quite boring. And, you know, you have a little bishop branch president there that runs your meetings, and they just loved my playing. Well, and it became a bit of a thing at the MTC at the time that there was this elder that was really going crazy with all the hymns and just having a lot of fun with them. And, you know, I was really proud of that. Well, a couple of months later on my mission, when a new group of missionaries came in from the MTC, told me that they'd been warned by the choir leader at the MTC not to be like a certain elder that had just left a few months before, that had taken God's sacred hymns and had turned them into something that were so awful. And I just remember, you know, that was sort of my first time thinking, really? I just, you know, that really sort of hurt. Now, I didn't really like the MTC. That was probably my first time I realized that things were really weird. I had never been sort of part of a church that felt so hierarchical and very patriarchal and full of rules. And I have to say, I struggled with that throughout my mission. And I was a pretty good kid. I didn't really do anything wrong. So I struggled very hard with not understanding rules that seemed very arbitrary. And that made things very difficult. So needless to say, to go back to my story about my friend in Poland, I did get a chance to meet her, but I realized very quickly in the MTC that I was not going to be allowed to see a 19-year-old girl on my mission and teach her the gospel. And that became abundantly clear. And I remember going to my mission president the first day I arrived in Warsaw and told him that that was why I was in Poland, was to be able to meet this girl. And he just sort of looked at me and said, okay, elder, we'll see. it was really difficult because we had a close relationship. We'd been friends for many years, and it was really hard for her not to understand how I could come to her country and not really interact with her. and I had to square that away. But anyway, that was a little bit about my mission, and it was a difficult mission in the sense that I hated the numbers. I hated working towards something I thought that was a business goal as opposed to actually helping people. And at a certain point in my mission, I basically said, I'm not going to do it anymore. And I still taught people and I still did everything that I was supposed to, but I didn't care about the numbers at all. And I usually reported zero, even if I had gotten more than that. In fact, I remember a particular elder, we decided that we were going to get zeros that week, and we were just going to talk to people. And I remember the mission president called and said, what's going on? And I said, nothing. This was our best week ever. We just talked to people, and we didn't worry about getting numbers, and we didn't keep track of them. And he was an interesting guy in the sense that he was very harsh when it came to the rules, but when you actually went and talked to them, he was sort of like a teddy bear. And that I really liked about him, but it was also a contrast, because on one hand, he was being who he was supposed to be as the mission president, and then on the other hand, he was telling us sort of privately that he didn't really agree with all the rules and not to worry about it. And, you know, when I look back on it now, that was a very confusing message for me as an elder. But I love Poland. I love the people. I didn't like the mission. And when I got back, and I think this will come back later in the story, I didn't talk about it. I was done. I did not want to think about it. I had no interest in sort of reliving the glory days. I didn't have any baptisms on my mission. I had really no luck, but in terms of what the church would consider a successful mission. But from a personal point of view, it was really an important part of my life.
Well, so I think that now we should move to you guys meeting at BYU and your experience at BYU. Katie and Josh got married, a very typical Mormon age, whereas my marriage came quite a bit later.
Okay, well, I headed off to BYU at 18, mostly because I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life, and going to school seemed better than going to work. So I headed to BYU because I had two older sisters who were already there. So I figured I would just follow them out. It was a massive culture shock for me. I had never lived in an environment where Mormon culture was so prevalent, and these rules that people had, they treated as gospel. I'd never even heard of these rules. It was very confusing and off-putting for me. I really didn't enjoy it. I had a hard time making friends when I first got there because I just couldn't understand these people. It was like they were from a different country and we weren't speaking the same language. So the first semester was a little rough, and then yes, I met Joshua early in the second semester of school. I was still 18. He asked me out on a date. We went out on a date, and I think we saw each other almost every single day, or talked to each other every single day for the next 2.5 weeks. We decided to get married after 2.5 weeks.
Oh, dear.
And so I was 18 and engaged, and I think a bit shell-shocked because I did not have plans of getting married. But you always hear, you know, if you get the right answer, you need to do it. As a matter of fact, I remember saying to Joshua, well, we're engaged, so why don't we wait until next spring to get married? So we've been engaged like 1.5 years. And he said, I won't wait for you. He said, it's now or we're not doing it.
Oh, hormonal Joshua.
I think we should back up a little bit then. So I had gone to 1 year of school before my mission, and I had gotten into the music, dance, theater program at BYU. Because I was really into theater and music, as I mentioned. And I didn't realize it at the time, but the theater department at BYU is sort of where the liberals, as it were able to sort of successfully live and hide at BYU on campus. Not that they were doing anything wrong, per se, but they certainly were, you know, we could have beard cards because we were in a play, right? So we had extra excuses that we could use. And when I got back from my mission, my whole goal in life was pretty much twofold. get out of BYU as quick as possible, which meant had to find a wife and get out of there and go to New York City. I had a very strong sense of purpose when I had returned from my mission. Of course, that's what the church tells you to do, is you're supposed to get married quickly. Maybe I was had a little bit of hormones at that point.
And luckily it's worked out.
It worked out fine. Yeah, we basically got married in...
We were married 5.5 months after we got engaged, so it was total 6 months. Beginning to end, meeting to marriage, 6 months.
And it was good. I mean, we had a good courtship. I mean, I wouldn't say that we talked a lot. We talked through a lot of things. In fact, I would say, unlike other people we know, we talked and discussed how our marriage, we wanted it to be, I think, to a certain degree. We were very open with each other. I'm getting the stink eye a little bit.
Kind of. I don't know. I was a teenager. I was barely 19 when we actually got married, so
I mean,
I'm not sure I knew.
I know what I was attracted to, other than the fact that you're just attractive. But what were you attracted by?
Well, you swept me off my feet for one, and two, this is probably the antithesis of what everyone else is looking for in a spouse at BYU. What really impressed me is that he never talked about his mission. He was not churchy. He didn't bring church into every single conversation. He wasn't obsessed with his mission and what he'd done and telling every single story, which you will find often is the case when men come back, or boys, whatever they are, when they come back for their mission, can't really talk to people without bringing up their mission. Anyway, so that was a huge attraction for me, which is probably... not what attracted a lot of other people. Is I just felt like he was a normal human being who I could talk to and connect with on a level outside of the church.
Well, and I was attracted to Katie. We won't go into the gory details of how we ended up on our first date because it's really sort of embarrassing. But I was attracted to her because she seemed very different and sort of nonchalant. You know, if again at BYU, the girls are looking to try to get married, they're trying to do the right things and be Relief Society, this and that, and Katie was definitely not interested in that. I would see her getting in the car with like a bunch of friends on a Sunday afternoon, obviously going out for some fun, and I thought, wow, that's a little different than the normal BYU girl. So I think, you know, to a certain degree, without even knowing it at the time, we sort of connected because we were both living very classic Mormon lives, but we both sort of had very different opinions about it. We sort of a little bit of fish out of water in Utah.
And mention of that, you need to tell a couple of the experiences you had on the BYU campus.
Oh, so, you know, first of all, I think I mentioned I was in the MDT program, and it was a great group of people and many good friends still, but I was really shocked just about how... Well, on one hand, I love the religious part of what I learned. I really, truly had this sense that being in the theater and being in music was a way to sort of carry God's word in a way that wasn't, you know, in your traditional missionary sense. And I even lived that very much on my mission. I mean, I was more interested in setting up little concerts and cultural events that I thought would help spread the word of God more than I was interested in knocking on somebody's door. So that really I liked about the theater. What I didn't like, though, was that there was this sense that once we left the cocoon of BYU, we were all going to go astray. Granted, most of us would go to New York City on tour, and we would have a lot of firesides and at people's homes, and a lot of the topic would center around how not to be gay, how not to fall into sexual deviancy, essentially. And, you know, at the time, I knew that some of my friends struggled. Of course, no one really came out and said anything, because you couldn't.
And this was the early 90s.
This is early 90s. So that was really difficult. The other thing that was going on at BYU at the time, obviously, was the whole sort of clean out of the liberal, quote-unquote, guard. And so I found it very hard to have sometimes relationships with some of the theater professors because they were very tenuous in what they could and couldn't say because there was just a very there was a strong fear. They needed a job. And, you know, I had some really brilliant people that I studied with, and it was just, you could tell they were holding back. The one thing that I do remember, and we were married, I think, at this time, was that there was the Rodin exhibit, which many people might remember at BYU. And I love art, and I love Rodin. And I was just so excited that BYU had made it possible for this exhibit to come. And then was shocked to find out that something as famous as The Kiss was not allowed to be in the exhibit because it was too sexual. Well, I was one of the 100 or so students who marched in front of the museum campaigning that BYU shouldn't
essentially censor art.
That if they were, and my whole thing was, is if you didn't think it was appropriate, you should have said no to the whole thing.
Why bring it?
Why bring it? And to me, that's sort of a common theme that you're going to see in my story throughout Mormonism, is you kind of, I feel like the church often wants their cake, but won't eat it all. And I know that's sort of a cliche gone wrong, because I do that very well. But, you know, they want to be part of the culture, they want to be part of the society, and that they always sort of deny half of that full experience. Well, what was really interesting at that time was, and I remember talking to Katie about this afterwards, is that I believe it was President Hinckley, had come out afterwards and said that the people who had marched against Rodin were really marching against God's word.
It's horrible.
I just... You know, it never even occurred to me that you could connect that. Mm-hmm. And that was really, I don't know, I don't remember, I don't think you marched with me that day, did you?
I think I was pregnant.
Yeah.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, we did get pregnant rather quick. So it was little things like that. I also had a brother who was there at BYU at the time, and he sort of unwittingly, and I guess, you know, you look back and say, okay, you should have known, but he went camping, and it was a co-ed camping trip, and ended up getting late, and so they decided to stay over and come back. Somebody ratted them out.
Nothing happened,
no,
but
nothing
it just happened to be co-ed.
And he ended up being sort of asked to come in and to defend himself as if he had done something wrong. And he admitted freely that he had done something that he shouldn't have because it was against the honor code. But what bothered me and him at the time, because he was my roommate, was that they assumed that something bad had happened. And there was a bit of a witch hunt that happened, and he was put on probation. And this was all happening sort of at the same time, again, along with people getting fired and stuff from BYU. And I just sort of, I tried very hard not to think too much about it. And my goal was to get to New York City.
All right, well, I will kind of jump in a little bit with my story. So I had mentioned previously that at age 20, I had some brain surgery. And after that, I was in a singles ward, and I had a visiting teacher who came and visited. And she said she was inspired to be telling all women that they should be considering to get their endowments out, even if they're not looking to go on a mission, that it was really important. And then she asked me how old I was. And I guess that was just a little bit before my tumor experience, because I was 19 at the time. And I remember saying that I was 19, and she was like, oh, well, maybe, and kind of hesitated. But soon after, I talked with my bishop, and I had a wonderful bishop at that time. And he said, you know what, his impression was that whenever a woman's asked about it, that means that she is ready and should do it. And so I went ahead. Now, a little backup is that I had the temple, and temple work were very much part of my patriarchal blessing. So I was prepped in a way to absolutely love the temple. It was a goal of mine. And so I went through the temple and received my endowments. And for me, it was a crazy experience. Like, I was overwhelmed by it. But my bishop had done a decent job of talking through what would happen. So I knew that there would be an initiatory where I'd be by myself. I knew that I wouldn't have clothes on. So I was prepped beforehand to know that, which was really helpful. I think I got a lot more information than most people. Still, the clothing during the endowment was odd and surprising to me. I didn't quite know what to make of the men's hats. I don't know how they designed those. But I loved it. I loved the experience, went through. It was powerful, beautiful. And then the next time I went, because I was determined to know that ceremony. And so I went the next time by myself. I wouldn't ever recommend that to somebody now, because it's so overwhelming. What do you do? What do you do next? And I remember a cute little old lady sitting next to me told me, leaned over as I was so proud of myself for doing everything and putting on everything. She told me I had done it wrong and that there was a specific order to putting on the clothes, and I had done it wrong. And I remember being horrified and embarrassed, and I soon came to learn that actually that's kind of a cultural myth that some people think and some people don't. But that was really embarrassing for me. But I was determined to know the temple. I became the temple chair in my ward. We went on lots of visits. It was very powerful. Soon after, though, I had a good friend who followed my footsteps and was endowed as well, and I was her escort. And for her, it was the complete opposite experience. She was overwhelmed by it, how much she felt like she was in a cult. She was not prepared. She just was overwhelmed by it. And actually, that was the start of her leaving the church. So it was interesting to have those two experiences happening very close together. But part of my personality is I'm really comfortable holding conflicting ideas. And somehow it didn't rock my boat that my friend was overwhelmed by this, and I could totally empathize with her and support her, whereas at the same time still hold my absolute love for the temple. That didn't challenge me too much. So that was my experience with the temple. We'll come back to my experience a little bit, but it seems like a good time to have you guys talk about your experiences with the temple.
Maybe I'll go first, because we obviously experienced...
Did it different. Mm-hmm.
I had my first experience before my mission. I was, I think, prepared spiritually to mm-hmm. a certain degree. Like, I definitely went to the classes and took a very, you know, I approached it and sort of knew that it was a serious thing to be doing. Mm-hmm. And I think my parents, very supportive and very excited. And so to that degree, I was prepared. To the degree that I knew what actually happened there, completely unprepared, had no clue. I would say that I took it all in stride. The initiatories didn't really bother me. I just assumed that, you know, if the church was true, everything mm-hmm. was fine. And I kind of, I think, held that feeling all the way through. If I remember correctly, my grandmother went through at the same time, who my grandfather had been baptized when he was younger, but didn't really ever, was never an active Mormon, really. There was a point where my grandmother realized that she could go to the temple without my grandfather, and so she decided to do it with me. And that was special. I mean, mm-hmm. I felt like I was very close to my grandmother, and it was a really sort of exciting to do that with her. But I'll be honest, I thought it was bizarre, and mm-hmm. I just couldn't understand the connection with what was going on in the temple to what I'd been taught my whole life. I did go on my mission, obviously, at the MTC. You can go to the temple often. I chose to go as least as possible.
Versus mine going every single week, yes.
I felt uncomfortable there. I mean, I liked the end of it where you got to sort of meditate. That part mm-hmm. I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was peaceful and beautiful. But leading up to it, I thought just I couldn't stay awake. I just couldn't. Mm-hmm. Just didn't make sense to me. And everyone kept saying that I was going to learn these deep, dark truths. Not dark. Dark is the wrong mm-hmm. word. But deep truths. And to this day, you know, I don't see any deep truths in it.
But they always twist it so that it's... as long as you're in tune.
Mm-hmm.
So it puts it all on you to get the
right
deep truths from it.
Now, by this point, I should say, I had done a year of theater in BYU and had been told I was not vulnerable enough to be an actor, which I was like, okay, great, good. I'm glad I have some validation. I'm just going to do the writing and music thing. I also had a hard time memorizing and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so it scared me to go to the temple because I couldn't remember what to say at the right time. And that just sort of overwhelmed the experience. So getting home from my mission, then I think I didn't go that often, but then, of course, I met Katie, and we decided to get married. I don't remember having sort of I need to go to the temple and find out if I should get married. I felt pretty strongly mm-hmm. without having to go to the temple. I think I did go just to confirm it. I probably didn't go that much more until we did get married.
So, Katie, did you go just, like, totally in... collaboration with the wedding? Like, was it the day before? Was it the...
And I didn't prepare you at all.
No, I got no information from anyone except for Joshua's bishop, because we got married at his home ward because I didn't live anywhere near a temple. And so...
And he was great.
He was good. But it was... We were scheduled to get married Saturday morning, and I received my endowments Thursday night.
Oh, it's so horrible for women like that.
And so, of course, you know, I was barely 19. Mm-hmm. It was this huge event. I was getting married. I hadn't even thought about going through the temple because no one had ever said anything to me about it. My parents said nothing to me about it. Your parents didn't say anything. My bishop, who gave me my recommend, didn't say anything about it. We went into, I don't remember why, we went to meet with Joshua's bishop the night before we got married. Or no, the night before I went to receive my endowments. And he said to me, he said, well, have you, I hadn't taken classes, nothing. He said, have you heard anything about it? And I said, no, I don't know anything. And he said, well, I just want to tell you that they would never ask you to do anything that was wrong in the temple. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, what does that mean? And I was so freaked out, because then I thought, wait a minute, I was all hyped for this whole marriage thing and everything that comes after it. And then I thought, okay, I don't really know what I'm getting myself into now. Mm-hmm. And I was totally freaked out. And then I went through the temple, and my mom was my
escort.
And I just, the whole initiatory, I just thought, oh my gosh, this is so weird. I don't like this. I don't like this. I don't like this. I don't like this. I think that was running through my head the entire time that I was in the initiatory. And then the endowment, I just thought, this is weird. Why are we doing this? This is weird. And so we finished it, and we ended in the celestial room, which I got to sit with Joshua. I thought that was very nice, but I thought, I don't want to do that again. We didn't for months, I don't think, afterward. We, I have to say, in our marriage, were infrequent visitors to the temple. I did not like it. I did initiatories not again until 4 years later. I was pregnant, so I guess I figured, who the heck cares? I'll do it. I've already been naked during childbirth. What does it matter here? But
we pretty much stopped.
That was it. I did two initiatories.
They made the changes of the initiatory. So we always were there was.
Yeah, I went to do initiatories twice in our entire, in my entire time going to the temple. And they were both before 2005.
Yeah.
Before any changes.
Okay, so at this point, we're going to talk a little bit about our journeys to New York City. Even though we never knew each other in New York City, when we met later on, the fact that we had all lived in New York City was one of the things that drew us to one another. We keep kind of jumping back and forth, so I apologize for that. But one of the things about my getting the temple and why it was so wonderful for me was it was the doing it my own way. I was breaking, in a sense, kind of the rules of the church, the cultural rules. I had no interest in a mission, and I was nowhere, anywhere near a marriage. In fact, I didn't get married for 8.5 more years. So I loved that idea of doing it my own way. So part of the other part of this critical thinking of my own, I guess, is that I was a social worker. And at the time, and this is about 98, 99, I was working with kids who were in really bad, they had been in really bad home lives in their biological families, and their foster families had been just really bad situations, and they were all desperate, absolutely desperate to have one consistent adult in their life to love them. And as that's important for the background of why this was so upsetting to me, around 98, 99, I can't remember exactly, there was legislation in Utah that was passed that no single adult could foster or adopt a child if they were cohabitating with another single adult. And it was really, even though the language of LGBT was never put in there, it was felt so directed to LGBT couples, as well as to heterosexual couples that didn't want to get married. And I just was so angry because I knew all of these kids who desperately needed homes. And I couldn't understand why the church was backing this. They were openly backing it. And so in my naivety, I'm still very much TBM, loving the church. I write a letter to the church and said, please help me understand why you're politically active on this issue, but not on poverty or healthy wage or so many other things that benefit our society. And it was really hard for me. And I, of course, expected something a little bit more in response. And instead, they sent me basically a form letter back saying, which any of you who've sent letters now to the church understand, it's the typical letter that gets back. I just didn't know that. And it said basically I needed to talk to my local leaders about the issue, and that was it. They didn't sympathize with me. They didn't anything. It was just go talk to your local leaders. And it angered me because my local leaders have no effect on their church's political involvement. That is totally the headquarters of the church. And so this really rocked my boat. I was so upset. So many nights of tears over this one. It shattered my view of the church as an organization. That they wouldn't even have the decency to talk, to give me some information. I did go to see my bishop, and again, he was a lovely, this is actually a different bishop than before my temple experience, but he also was such a wonderful, lovely man. And he sat with me, and as I was crying and saying how hard this was for me, and he just said, you know, this is, he just basically had no answer. He had no answer for it. And that kind of helped me to understand that he didn't, that this was prejudice and he didn't want to say it, but he, I could tell he was kind of in the same place, the struggle. So that's what started for me kind of the road of really questioning the church. But I moved to New York City, soon after 9/11. And I loved it. I loved the independence of New York City. It was one of my goals to live there. And my experience in the church in New York City was I did it on my own terms. I very much got into this mode of doing it on my own terms. And the one thing that I took away from being, I loved the inner city ward. I loved it. I was in an inner city ward. It wasn't the typical Manhattan ward where there's just
a bunch of Utah.
Yeah, Utah transplants. I was in the inner city and had very...
You were in the Bronx.
I was in the Bronx. So I was in a very diverse background and I loved it, that part of it. But the thing that really troubled me was the missionary program. We were struggling. We didn't have a very strong infrastructure, and yet we were baptizing like crazy. I remember coming in and sitting down one time, and the entire back rows were filled with missionaries for just our ward. I don't remember the number, but it was absurd. It was like 18 missionaries were assigned to just our ward. And I thought, you can't keep baptizing at this rate because we're never going to be able to retain it. So that was an eye-opener. When we meet again, we will meet again in a
similar situation
in an inner city ward again, where that missionary program was like that again. And so I had two back-to-back experiences of loving the diversity of the ward, but absolutely hating the missionary program. That's mostly what came for me with New York City was independent. I was very on my own, loving it. I was not a typical Mormon woman in that way. I was endowed, but I had no need for marriage, and I had my career and loving it. So that was my experience.
I think to a certain degree, we both sort of came to New York and lived our own lives too. Mm-hmm. But as a married couple, especially with Katie, who was 20 at the point, or were you still 19?
I was 21.
21.
When we had a six-month-old baby.
You know, our parents were, we could call it somewhat supportive, because my parents believed that, you know, I should go to New York and follow my dreams. They just weren't so fond that it was the New York part that I had to go to.
It was very much follow your own dreams, but you're on your own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we kind of relished in that. We had a pretty horrible first couple of days in New York.
Which we won't go into.
Katie doesn't like to talk about, where we almost lost all of our belongings and such. But, you know, I remember having a conversation with Katie and saying, either we're going to do this together or this is probably, you're probably, you know,
no, we got to New York. We had a really bad experiences at the beginning. And I said, I'm going to go to my parents. And he said, you can't leave. If you leave now, you're not ever going to come back. And so I didn't go until I think a couple months later or something like that. And it's probably true. I don't know that I would have come back if
Because it was such a bad experience.
Because it was a bad experience.
But that changed everything. I think once we just decided, hey.
Because it made us a unit.
Yeah.
We were then a unit. It was us
in the
together against the world, I guess. I don't know.
And it felt that way. I mean, that is funny because at that point we decided we were going to. Now, I was going to New York to work in the theater and music industry, and I had every intention of succeeding, and Katie supported me 100% in that. And we decided right there and then, no matter how bad it was, this was home, and this, we were gonna make the most of it. And I think within 6 months and even maybe a little longer, we really fell in love with Brooklyn.
Yes.
To the point where we felt it was absolutely our home.
Mm-hmm.
We struggled. There were times we couldn't pay the bills. We couldn't even eat sometimes. And I think the important thing there is we never really felt like it was the church that necessarily provided us that. It was sort of us, and we liked that. We didn't want to feel beholden to the church. But having said that, we made some amazing friends in Brooklyn that are still friends today. That, without them, I don't know where we'd be. And I think that certainly helped us and kept us. We weren't typical in the sense that we had a hard time saying family prayers a lot. We didn't
felt like we should say family prayers and we should read scriptures. And it was just so infrequent. And it just wasn't us. So
and we talk about everything.
Didn't do
but
it.
We didn't talk about religion.
No.
It just was sort of this elephant in the room all the time. I think we both sort of knew that we were both a little, wary of jumping 100% into every church activity and church thing. I think Brooklyn was really interesting, and obviously some of the friends that we made there will figure in a little later into our story. But, this is the point where I'm working really hard in the theater. And just a little quip here, just to go back to the experience at BYU. At a certain point, I was writing, I had a potential Broadway show, and so there was a lot of momentum there and a lot of interest in what I was doing, having come from BYU, and I got invited to go to a conference at BYU to talk about Mormon arts. And it was essentially really some of the top Mormon artists, I would say, in theater and film and that sort of thing. And the question or the thesis was, why are there no really famous Mormon artists?
Or, active Mormon artists.
Right. Yeah. Or what is it that we can do to create like the America or the Mormon musical or the Mormon play? And I think it was a really eye-opening experience for me because as an artist, I had been struggling with this because on the one hand, you want, as a writer, as a dramatist, it's all about drama and conflict and things that don't quite make sense. And what we realized from that BYU conference is that you can't really write a Mormon play.
As long as you stay TBM, you can't.
Right, without potentially shaking someone's testimony or not promoting faith. And even one of the guys said, why can't we have a Mormon Fiddler on the Roof? But you look at that show and you realize that show is all about
breaking traditions
mm-hmm. and breaking out of the mold of sort of the cultural doctrines, as it were. And so at this point, I think, there was a struggle. There was an internal struggle between truth and the big T of humanity and trying to tell the story, and truth sort of in the church way. And we struggled a little bit with that, both probably me more than you, but just trying to figure out, here we are in this really big, bad city that our parents don't really love to come to visit, or they're not terribly supportive that we're there. They're proud of us, but they're not terribly supportive of it. And yet we're meeting some of the nicest people we've ever met. We're in the middle of two projects, a Black project and a Hispanic project, and there's just these conflicts that are happening in front of us, and then there's these amazing moments also happening, and it's just this, you get this mix of people that you would never see. We were in Brooklyn, so we weren't in the Manhattan wards either.
Mm-hmm. But I think that you need to talk about being called as a branch president.
Well, so a couple things happened. We'd moved from one place in Brooklyn to a smaller, or to a different part of Brooklyn that was sort of the stepchild of, because Brooklyn is, somewhat hip, and there's a lot of young people that move there, especially younger families in the church. But there was a place called which is now really hip and cool.
Now.
And this area it was much more of a mix of singles and a lot of people, very poor people, and a lot of people who struggled And I have to tell you, it was probably the best branch we've ever been in our entire lives.
Yes. The most sincere people with the biggest problems. And they were at church not because they had to be at church. They were at church because they needed that place. They needed the people. They had a real sense of community that was supposed to be in the church, but I felt didn't really exist in most of the wards that we were in. They were just so open, and they were there because they were imperfect, and they knew they were imperfect, not because they were putting on a front. They were just incredibly sincere people, but they had so many big problems.
You know, it was like the kind of people that would be smoking out in front of church, and you'd say, "Hey, brother," you know, and he'd say, "Hey," back, and then he'd come up in testimony meeting and say, "You know, sometimes when I'm in church, it's the only 3 hours I can't smoke, and it's good. Like, and I just like being here with people that say, 'You can make it.'" I mean, I just didn't ever see that. I've never seen that in any other ward. Well, our branch president gets to become the district president, and there's a bit of a vacuum in the branch. Now, mind you, there's mostly wards in New York, so a branch, especially in Brooklyn, is a little bit of a... It was very wide geography. There's a lot, like I said, that you had a few wealthy people or students that are coming to study graduate school, but for the rest, it was mostly fairly poor, lower middle class. Anyway, they asked me to be branch president. And I had been branch president once before, actually, on my mission, rather unsuccessfully, because they let me go after 2 months because I was actually cleaning out the ward rosters and allowing people who were not interested in being part of the church to...
resign.
It wasn't very popular. They don't like negative numbers on the mission. So anyway, I said, sure, I'll be. And I had a lot of hesitation, actually, because I was still, I was literally trying to get my career going in the theater. I also had a full-time job. At this point, we had 2 kids under 4. We also had no vehicle. It was a 10-mile by 10-mile radius, which is pretty large for New York City. It might even be more than that. And it was some of the worst pockets of poverty and violence in Brooklyn and Queens, because it actually was Queens. And I told them that I had these issues, and they said, "Oh, don't worry, everything will be fine." And I said, "Okay." And I don't want to go into too many details, but...
Let's just say how it affected you and your testimony.
I think for me, it was the first time that I was sort of... So as a missionary, I felt concerned and a bit disgruntled with the numbers and just sort of the general business aspect of the church. But I felt that, you know, there wasn't a whole lot I could do about that. You just go on your mission, you kind of have to do what they say, and then you're going to get through it and you can go home. Now as a branch president, all of a sudden, supposedly I did have power to kind of make the changes that I wanted. Outside of a mission context, and found out very quickly that actually there wasn't a whole lot I could do, and that I was actually being called because of some of the decisions that I'd made from the people above me. And then oftentimes those people would get called by the people above them, you know, for example, potentially giving money to somebody from the fast offerings that I felt was in need, or helping some of the youth that had had some sexual sins or other sins that they were dealing with, and me going through the process, but
forgiving them.
Other people basically, yeah, feeling that maybe I shouldn't have. There was also the fact that my meetings were about an hour away. They never started on time. I wouldn't get home till 1 o'clock in the morning. We never actually accomplished anything in these meetings. Most of the time they were fighting about what I thought were just ridiculous,
petty
things. And of course they were not doing it in a mean-spirited way, but I just kept sitting there and thinking, really? This is like, we're all inspired leaders, we're district presidents, branch presidents, area, I mean, and we can't even figure out how to put a temple trip together without crying and fighting. So very quickly, did we talk about this? I think we did at this point. You knew that I was really frustrated.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And I was frustrated.
And I was going to say, how was it for you to be your branch president's wife? Because you have 2 little kids at home.
Well, I was not only the branch president's wife. I was the first counselor in primary and a Relief Society teacher all at the same time. Mm-hmm. I was 24 I had two kids, one of which was a 4-month-old, and I had to take the bus and then walk about 10, 12 blocks from the bus stop to church every Sunday morning on my own because Joshua had to be there early.
Now, you were how old? You were
24.
So I was 27.
Yes, he was 27, mm-hmm. which was, it was very funny because being in a Relief Society teacher, I would have some of the older women come up to me and tell me how they said, when he first got called, I thought, how can that little boy tell me what to do? You know, and they said, but he's just so great because he was very young and we had we didn't have a large population. There were maybe 45 active members of our branch, but a lot of them were older women. And so, you know, 40s and up,
yeah,
older
that
were, than
had
us.
Kids, that
yes.
were single,
so,
youth.
You know, it was, they really were actually upset when he was first called because he was so young. And then I was the branch mother, apparently, at 24. I was so young. I had little babies. And it was incredibly difficult because I felt like I had to be on all the time, even though they were a very sincere ward and everyone just was very accepting. I felt like I am supposed to be an example for this branch, not ward. It was our branch. I had to be an example at 24 for everyone. Yeah. I was supposed to show them how this was supposed to be done, what mm-hmm. you were supposed to be like.
It's a lot.
It was a lot of pressure. And I was a working mother. Mm-hmm. I couldn't stay home. We couldn't afford it. I had two kids. I was a working mom. I had two different callings.
And her husband was working in the theater industry.
And my husband was.
Which is not exactly a lucrative career unless you're at the top. Well, let's talk about the missionary because you mentioned missionary too. But before I say that, I had this really interesting feeling that when I was at work, I was literally an assistant to an older woman, mm-hmm. Very powerful woman in the theater industry. And I remember thinking when she would be yelling at me, "You don't even know. I am in charge of 100 ladies, men,
450 people on our list.
That I'm helping them with issues of abortion and sexual purity, and you know, you have no idea." And then I would go home and think, "But wait a minute, I actually have no power to change any of these people's lives other than to try to help the best I can." And that I really liked. I did like that a lot. Now, this is where the missionary thing comes back in. And Katie probably has more to say about this than I, but I, again, still never believed in numbers. And when you have a poor ward or branch, especially in an urban area, there's a lot of opportunity to baptize because people are in need. Mm-hmm. And I hate to say it, but I think the church takes advantage of this
way too
often. And we had 4 missionaries in a branch where there was only 45 people, and they were baptizing people once a week. And I half the time didn't even know these people. Mm-hmm. And they were coming in for an interview and supposed to get baptized at 2:00 that afternoon. And I finally said to the missionaries, "No, I won't do it. And if you have the baptisms, I will not show up and support them because these people weren't coming back because mm-hmm. nobody even knew who they were." Well, the missionaries got really upset. One day in particular, Katie earned the nickname of the Wildcat.
So how about you tell that?
So I was in the primary presidency, as I said, and I had the president was 21. A 1-year-old woman. And so she didn't know a lot about procedures and she felt, you know, a little overwhelmed by the whole thing. So she would look to me for advice with my vast experience, my whole 3 years that I had on her. And we were kind of constantly having a battle with the missionaries over our room because our primary room was the baptismal font room. And we had limited space. There was really nowhere else for us to go with the primary kids. And we had not only our children, but the deaf branch children. And it was a real struggle just to keep them occupied and in one place with the limited leadership we had. So I noticed the missionaries were beckoning to the primary president. They were outside the door and they were waving her out. And I thought, oh, this is not going to be good. So I said, "Just let me take this. You stay here. I'll go deal with it. Don't worry about it." She walked out into the hall, actually, after. No, what happened was she went out, and I followed her out. That's what happened. And they had cornered her and said, listen, we have a baptism and it was during our primary. And so they needed the baptismal font room and we were just going to have to find somewhere else to go. And I was so angry because this had happened so many times and the kids would just get all out of sorts. And it was just such a pain. It was awful. And I walked up to the missionary and I said, no. And he said, what do you mean, no? And I said, no, you will have to change your baptism. I said, we are not moving those kids. And he said, well, you are stopping the work of the Lord by not allowing us to have this baptism. And I said, you are stopping the work of the Lord because I have 15 children who will be baptized someday. And you have one person who's not going to come back next week. I said, so you are stopping the work of the Lord. You will not hold that baptism until we are done. And he said, well, I'm going to talk to the branch president. And I said, good luck. I sleep with him. And he was so mad at me. And I know that it went to the mission president because I think Josh got a call about it, but I didn't care. I was so angry with him. He just felt like he was above me because he was doing the work of the Lord. And I, a little lady, was just trying to step in his path and do something that I didn't have the authority to do. And that, I just have left such a terrible taste in my mouth. I'd never had a great love for the missionary program, but that really, really was definitely a bad experience. And then it was compounded, we're going to segue now, to where we met Kim in a different inner city ward. We had all moved to
on the East Coast,
a different city. We had moved there earlier. We met Kim, I think, a couple years after we'd moved there. As Kim mentioned before, this is where we were in a small ward with 8 missionaries, or
at least
12 missionaries.
Well, hold on. So, because we moved to this city, and because of a job for us, and we were really excited because we love living in the city, and it was part of. We love the diversity. At this point, I would say our biggest struggle was sort of realizing that we love a big city, diversity, all these cultures, different ways of doing things. We love that about the city. And we're starting to see a little bit of, like, you know, a contrast between that and sort of there's this only one way of doing everything. So we moved to this new city and really excited about the prospect of being sort of in a different urban environment. We knew it wasn't quite as sophisticated as maybe New York, but, you know, we were really excited about it. And I think you guys ended up coming, now at this point.
I'm married at this point, so right. I guess maybe I should jump back a little bit because we were going to transition with the idea of missionary work. But let me just quickly give a transition, jump in first. I met my husband 6 years previous to us getting married, so we are not the typical Mormon experience. And we both traveled and lived in New York City, single, separate New York City experiences. But then we eventually got married and moved to a new city. And when we did, it was interesting because there was a ward house around the corner from our apartment, yet we couldn't go to that one. It was a different stake. So instead, we had to travel 40 minutes to get to the one that we met you in. I don't know what to really mention about my marriage at this point, so that will probably come up a little bit later on. So let's get back into the transition to the ward that we were in with the missionary program.
Well, and I think we sort of connected pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know, I know for us it was like, oh, there's these people from New York.
Finally.
We've been there now for
a year and a half,
and I'll tell you, it was a struggle because this was an inner city ward for the most part. There were a lot of students that came and went, and there was really, it was just very difficult. And now I was coming out of being a branch president too, having a lot of issues in general with just sort of the church and knowing how it works.
Well, and might we mention that at this point he had almost stopped going to church after he was branch president. So he was, I would say for a few months, 4 or 5 months, pretty much inactive. He didn't go to church at all.
I did it, and it was because I was, and I, at this point, it wasn't because I thought that it was untrue. I just was having, I was frustrated with how it worked as an organization. So I think that's important when we start talking about how come we left. At that point, I still felt a huge amount of, or a sense that the church was true ultimately. I just didn't get the sense that the actual church organization and the culture of the church was doing it. So by this time, Katie and I are a little bit frustrated with where we are. We hadn't really made a lot of friends in the church. Mm-hmm. And in come this new couple from New York, and we're so excited. I remember we were like, yay! We have some built-in friends. You know, and we're very different, I think. Our backgrounds are different. Yeah. Sort of our whole, you know, life stories are a bit different, even though we've been focusing on some of the things that are the same. But there was an immediate sort of respect for having lived in
and camaraderie.
New York and camaraderie. And then we quickly realized that also we shared a very strong
liberal street.
Liberal intellectual street. And I think that you guys were probably one of the first couples that we were able to talk sort of openly on an intellectual level. Yeah. I don't think we ever got very critical.
No.
Other than, you know, it was like, hey, what did you think about Elders Quorum or Relief Society? And then we could actually talk about it beyond just the what you're not, you know, what you're supposed to say, church.
And I have to jump in. One time I remember how nice it was to have you guys. And when you moved away, how hard it was for me. Because one time I remember vividly sitting in a lesson when, unfortunately, homosexuality came up from the teacher and it was handled really poorly. And the only way I got through it was because I could sit by Josh and say, what, you know, and being able to just have somebody there that I knew could understood my perspective on gay issues. So that was a little...
Well, and I think, you know, at this point, it's important to say that, I'm just going to say it, I grew up with a very conservative family, and I pretty much held to those sort of political and moral conservative beliefs. When we got to New York and started to see sort of the what happens sort of in real life with that diverse cultures coming together, and also having lived in really poor circumstances, because it was very expensive to live in New York, those political, all those issues, like it morphed. And Katie and I sort of, she mentioned a liberal streak. I mean, by this point, we're very liberal compared to sort of the normal conservative politics you would find at the church. And so it was, I think, the first time we were able to kind of talk openly about sort of all of these things. And you know, I think, like, homosexuality, this was an important one because I had a lot of gay friends at this point, obviously, in the theater. Mm-hmm. We had one of my best friends, our best friend is gay, and he would come and visit us all the time. And our kids would ask questions like, why on earth is it okay
bring his boyfriend
uncle, because they called him uncle, you know, why could
why is he kissing a boy,
right? Why am I learning that they're evil at church, and then our best friend, he's the nicest person in the world and we love him to death, why? So we were already facing that early on, and when you guys came, it was kind of like, oh, I mean, we can finally talk about some of these issues, because who else, you can't really go and talk about this in priesthood. Oh, one of our best friends is gay, and we don't know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, that's not something you talk about. So,
well, let me jump in with the
fresh air.
Yeah, sorry. Just trying to get over here. But I think one of the things about this ward that we're in is at that time there was a mission president who was over it that was very focused on numbers. So this is not a healthy place for any of our stories coming from being already really struggling with the missionary program in inner city urban environments. To go into a ward that has a mission president that is so focused on numbers. And at that time, it was not uncommon for our sacrament meeting to start out with names, lists of names of 15 individuals that they're calling to be confirmed who are not there. So they were baptized 1 week previous. And
or 15 and 8 of them were there. So we started sacrament 45, 50 minutes late.
Because all we did was have confirmations. And then those people didn't last. I mean, it was ridiculous. At one point, I remember a little kid shouting to his mom, how many more prayers are there? Because we had so many confirmations sometimes. And it was so discouraging because they didn't stay. They weren't truly converted. It was all about just getting the numbers. I remember being in primary presidency and a little girl was visiting and the missionaries were pushing and pushing to have her baptized. And I told them outright, I said, if you baptize her before her mother is baptized, we will never see her again. And they went ahead and baptized her and we never saw her again.
Well, and you have to remember that, again, this is a very inner city ward and, you know, on one hand, I was happy to see some of these people coming because they were getting help.
Yes.
But it was physical help. It mm-hmm. was food, money, and things like that. And, you know, having been a branch president, I'd done that in the branch in New York. But I also knew that it was short-lived. It wasn't about an actual testimony or faith.
But I will jump in and say one of the things I have noticed in the inner city ward, why I stayed a long time in it, is because it does draw some people that the church works for. The church provides a single mother with her kids an opportunity to have adult men in their life. And that is the beautiful part of the church. What was a struggle for me was this number concept, baptize, 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 baptize. Luckily, that mission president was released and things dramatically changed.
Well, the ward fell apart.
And
the
one, that's true. And
not before, like, 150 people were baptized
Yeah, which was absurd. And now those names are still on our ward list.
And I remember actually hearing, and it was a general conference, about certain wards in the East Coast that were baptizing like crazy and how proud they were. And, you know, literally just saying, we can't even teach these kids. Now, I think where it gets really interesting and where we get very intertwined here is that Katie's involved very specifically with the youth.
And so was I.
And you, we worked together.
Yeah, and
we were both
well.
In the young women's, and then later on I was in the primary.
So why don't we, because I think that probably...
Well, all the stories.
I will just share one story that I absolutely, and this is like part of why I love the church in inner city. So we have this mix of hating it and loving it. Is I remember teaching a Mother's Day mothering lesson and to these youth, because you realize these are inner city kids that are, because the young, so even though we have students coming in, all the students have little kids. So it's primary and nursery that have all the Utah transplants in our ward. So our young women's are newly converted individuals who are from the inner city. And I remember teaching this lesson on mothering and asking them, so what kinds of things do you need to know before you someday become a mother? And the first young girl raised her hand and she said, know who your baby's daddy is? And I remember thinking, indeed, knowing who the father of your baby is highly important before mothering.
Highly recommended.
Yes, and... But I love that because I can work with that. And I think both Katie and I are the kind of personalities that jump on that and love it and don't shame them for saying that. But
that also puts you in a predicament, though, because dealing with girls who are sexually active,
yes.
who have children, who are from broken families, there is no script for that in the young women program or the young men program.
Well, and luckily I'm a social worker, so I can pull off of my professional experience. And I thought it turned out to be an awesome lesson. But you think about... Those girls aren't in the church anymore because the manuals are written for suburban Utah from 1985. and they have nothing that connects to their life in the inner city. And when you throw the For the Strength of Youth pamphlet at them, they're like, what do you mean? You know, like it makes no sense to them. It gives them no concrete way to look at their life that's applicable to their life and to their understanding. Because, of course, her answer to the question was, I should know who my baby's daddy is an important part of mothering.
Well, and I feel like the reason that inner city ward worked for me was because it was not about teaching the gospel to those girls.
Yes.
It was about teaching basic life skills, providing love, support, encouragement, being a standard fixture in their life. I mean, I went to mathlete competitions. I went to choir concerts. I went to band concerts. I went to extracurriculars for any of these girls. And not just once, I went repeatedly. I went and took prom pictures of the girls with their dates because we were really...
Surrogate
parents. We were the surrogate adult in their life because out of all of those girls, one had a mom and a stepdad in the home. Every other child was from a single parent home, and oftentimes the parent wasn't there. And so for me, it was really humanitarian aid. Mm-hmm. It was helping those girls become responsible adults that can make good decisions. It wasn't about, you know, following the Strength of Youth pamphlet. It wasn't about, you know, any of the church stuff so much. It was about teaching them how to be responsible adults.
So do you guys think that, you know, because at this same time, I obviously wasn't in Young Women. I was playing the organ, for which I often do, especially when I'm very interested in not being in anything else position. I was playing the organ, and which is one of the things I love most about going to church, was actually playing the music. But at this time, I was basically struggling to try to figure out, what is it that I believe? Do I believe in the doctrine of the church, and I just can't deal with the culture and organization? And if so, do I really even need to go to church, as long as I'm getting some sort of spiritual benefit out of it and believe in God or you know, Jesus, that sort of thing? And you were incredibly invested at this point in time. You were,
but
too.
But also not doctrinally. Like, we were invested
in the kids.
In the kids, because...
And serving, mm-hmm. and helping. It wasn't so much about...
And I think that, like, it's... We did, I thought, a really good job of not pushing doctrine down them. But I remember visually looking at the girls when modesty would come up, or other law of chastity lessons would come. Like, you could see we were losing them, because that did not resonate with them. What resonated with them was caring about their life, listening to them, supporting them, like Katie going out and visiting their places.
Having opportunity.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's wonderful, but it's time-consuming. It's exhausting. Mm-hmm. You have a family of your own. You're stretched thin.
Equate that, like, you know, this is coming from a truth point of view. In other words, the church is providing at least... you know, sort of a foundation of truth that we're giving onto these girls, or did it not even matter to you?
No, because, and also, of course, now we're looking back, because this is what, maybe 2005, 2006?
Yeah.
2005?
Yeah.
And looking back on it, I'm still in that ward boundaries, and none of those girls, not one of the teens that we worked with, is there one?
She doesn't live here.
Live in that ward. Okay.
Right.
Is even associated with the church anymore. And so I think what we provided for them was something they needed, but they could have found in other locations had they been given the opportunity. A YMCA or some other opportunities might have provided it for them, but they found it through the church. And I think that that's okay. One thing I will point out is because of my resistance to the missionary program, we had some neighbor children who wanted to go to church with us, and I... so dragged my feet on it. Like, they could come, but my husband and I protected them from the missionaries and kept saying, like, please don't visit them yet. They're not ready. They just want to play and have fun. And I remember that eventually the missionaries got a hold of them. And I remember asking the young man before he got baptized, like, you don't have to be baptized. It's okay. You can keep coming. You shouldn't feel pressured. And he said to me, he goes, Miss Kim, it keeps me out of trouble. And I like it for that. Mm-hmm. And I remember at that point totally backing down and saying, you know what? For him, it works because it kept him out of trouble. Now, he's not in the church anymore, but for a year, it kept him off the streets. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I can't argue with the church, because it provided something he wouldn't have found anywhere else.
Right.
And so this is where I get a struggle, because I know how damaging the church for me finally was. But at the same time, for some people, it really works. And I look at some of the single moms and their kids in the ward, and the church is providing surrogate parenthood for some of those kids, and they desperately need it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, they could find it. I've heard on Mormon Expression many times, well, you can find that anywhere. But some of these kids can't.
They don't know where to look.
They have limited resources, and the church came along and is providing that for them.
So for me at this point, you know, you two are really busy. And if I remember right, your husband, I think he had a calling in the ward too at this point. So everyone was really busy. I'm playing the organ. So as long as I show up, I was pretty good. I think around this time we started having some more conversations about the church, and you gave me a book. Mm-hmm. Remember what it was?
Yeah, I think I gave you the Grant Palmer book.
Yeah, I think that was the one.
The Origins of Yeah.
And I remember thinking,
insider's view,
I probably shouldn't read this. This must be apostate. But I, you know, I read the thing about him and realized, you know, he's a, he, I think he was active at that point or just.
Yeah. I don't think he had been disfellowshipped yet. Yeah.
So I read the book and, you know, not really expecting anything. And I remember thinking after finishing it, wait a minute, there's more things in this book that make sense than anything I've ever sort of read. And I wasn't even looking to sort of make sense of that. I mean, the Joseph Smith story for me was just sort of, it was what it was. I think even to a certain degree, I probably had a testimony that it was true. But everything just didn't quite line up. I read this book and all of a sudden I'm like, whoa, this is interesting. Now, mind you, I didn't go off and start studying. Normally I'm that way. I go study everything. I just kind of put that one away on the side and said, that's interesting because maybe it's not just the organization of the church I have a problem with. Maybe it's actually the whole church. So I think, you know, maybe the last little bit here, because we end up, Katie and I end up moving a short time after, but at around this time, we also, there's a death in the ward of, of a dear friend that's a friend of both of ours. And without going into too much details, you know, I think that shook us all very much in the sense that we had to sort of look inward, both to help our friend and to kind of get through it ourselves. And I remember just being in a position quite often trying to talk both to the people around me, but trying to explain things and really realizing I didn't have any answers. I even remember calling my dad and saying, you know, this all made sense until you actually have to explain it, and then it doesn't make sense. Yeah. So what do you do? And I remember him trying to explain it to me.
We have to explain that our friend who passed away had a wife who we were very dear friends with, and a six-week-old baby. So he left behind a devastated wife and a tiny baby. And trying to explain to her why this would happen when his patriarchal blessing specifically said otherwise. What was she supposed to do now? No one was going to want to marry her because she couldn't be sealed in the temple again. You know, none of these answers that you get made sense or answered her questions.
And that was like a, you know, okay, so you have the history, you have the organization, you have the culture. Now we're talking about doctrine.
Yeah. Well, and I think also I wasn't as close to these friends because we had just moved at this time, but I loved them. And I just felt so kind of similar to like when I first met you guys. And I wanted to know them. And the individual that passed away was so loving, so caring, liberal-minded, brilliant, in great health. If God was all-powerful, he's the kind of person you want representing this church. You want him out there in the world. And that kind of, like, I'm still on, like, my final strings of things making sense. And that sudden death made zero sense. And there was no doctrinal anything that could help make sense of it.
You know, it's kind of the old adage that, you know, at least growing up, I always thought, oh, I know where I'm going. If somebody dies, I'll be fine. And then it happens. And then it's not fine. And that pretty much, I think, shook all of us up. And you basically spent almost 3 months almost completely helping her get through it. And it was pretty quick after that that I got a new job opportunity or a new, actually, school opportunity to get my master's degree. I'm switching from theater to fashion, which is a whole topic in and of itself. But I'm going to, back to New York City to get my degree. We don't end up in the city per se, but in the same area. I think we're all kind of left now at this point in sort of different scenarios of our faith. I'm struggling with the organization of the church. I'm now struggling with the doctrine and feeling like I didn't have any answers for this friend. We moved to and all of a sudden you don't have the purpose anymore in the young women program. That you had.
Right.
Maybe. I don't know. Kim, why don't you, because we left you behind. So why don't you kind of take us through that, and then we'll, because I think this is where things start to break down.
And it's interesting, like, this is around the time that at this point, and soon after you leave, we have some other good friends that are struggling with the church. And I feel like at this point for the next, like, 4 or 5, well, I guess it's been 6 years then after that, I feel like I helped so many people leave the church. I feel like I was this magnet for people who knew I was a safe place to come talk to me about their questions. And because I was still active, I was somehow safe for them as well. And we kept having friends leaving the church. They'd come and confide in us. and we'd help them process things. And in the end, they chose to leave, yet I kept choosing to stay. And that was always interesting for me. One of the things I think for both Katie and me that's important for us to talk about is women's roles in the church. And so let me go quickly back a little bit to my marriage. Is I lived in New York City for 4 years on my own, single again. I'm doing church on my own at that point. I feel very empowered. I very much have just done things my way. I'm resistant to authority. I'm respectful, but I'm resistant to authority. And I got married and we moved. And it was almost like this weird instantaneous, these things in the church I've been taught that I had totally intellectually rejected, I am now emotionally trapped by. All of a sudden, the ideas of being a good wife, a good mother, because I became a mom soon after, overwhelmed me. And I had no purpose that I could figure out. I didn't know what I wanted out of my life. I knew I wasn't content. And it took me until now to recognize the church was the reasonings for that. And I think it was hard in my marriage sometimes because my husband liked the fact that I was this really outspoken, empowered woman. That is part of what attracted him to me. And he sometimes just was at a loss for words. Like, I don't know who you are. This isn't the person I married, because I would be insecure and wallowing and not knowing what to do with my life. And it just baffled him. He didn't know how to handle it. And I think, I mean, that jumps way ahead to now, but looking back on it, I realized that is what was happening to me. That pressure of all of those crazy messages were given as women growing up in the church, even if you reject it, it's still emotionally indoctrinating you into what you should be. And we talked about this a little bit before doing the recording, and that's not uncommon just to Mormonism. Like, it's not unique to Mormonism, but the struggle with those beliefs of being a good wife and a good mother, being attached to your worthiness and being attached to purely that's your only identity, I think isn't necessarily unique to Mormonism, but it is compounded by Mormonism significantly. And that's a huge part of my eventual leaving, is coming to terms with that, that I, for about a span of 7 years, lost my identity that I had had pretty strongly before it. And it wasn't my husband at all. It was the church's messages of being a wife.
And mine really was, I didn't have an identity. Mm-hmm. I was taught pretty much all the way through from primary all the way through high school that I was going to be a mom. That was what I was supposed to be. I was supposed to be a mother. I was supposed to be a mother. I was supposed to be a mother.
And then a wife.
Well, yeah.
But no, I mean, I remember having that conversation, you saying, you know, I've been a good wife, but I've been you. I've been doing everything you want to do. It's like,
well, and I got married very young because really that was expected. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I had never been encouraged to find something that I loved to do or be educated. I went to college for 3 years and then quit. I didn't finish. I never majored. And I really feel like I wasn't encouraged to do that unless it was childhood early development or family education or whatever the heck that major is. I didn't do that. But I felt like that was the only acceptable degree, because it's a degree so you can be a mom. And so I didn't have an identity. I mean, I was a very strong personality, but yeah, I got I got married and I tried very hard. I pretty much immersed myself in my husband's life, and I was really very supportive of him and his dreams, but they became my life because I didn't have anything for me. And then I became a mother, and I literally remember them sending me home from the hospital, and I thought, what am I supposed to do with this baby? Like, why are you sending her home with me? I don't know what I'm doing. And when she was 1 year old, we were living in New York, and Josh and I had sat down and talked, and I said, I'm going back to work. And I went back to work.
And I stayed home.
And Josh stayed home because I didn't know what I was doing. And I felt so out of my depth, and like I was such a terrible parent that I just had to get out of it for at least a little while because I was being crushed, completely crushed under the expectation and the responsibility of everything that I should have been doing. And I didn't have my own identity. It took me, 5-6 years in a major emotional crisis in my life in order to kind of go back to the beginning and pick up the pieces and find out who I was as a person, not as a mother, not as a wife, not as someone's daughter, not as anything to anyone else, but who I was. And that was an incredibly difficult journey in a marriage and as a parent.
Mm-hmm. And what about in the church, though? Because I think that affected the conversation more than anything else.
Well, yes, because there's so many expectations. Like I said, in the Young Women Manual, and even now, everything in that, every lesson in that manual is geared toward what you learn and what you become is all for someone else. Mm-hmm. It is for your children. It is not for you. It is not so you can grow as a person, so that you can be a better person. It is really for you to give away to someone else.
Well, and I remember at one point my husband asking me, I just don't understand what you want. And me being able to just be in tears saying, because I don't know what I want. I've never had to articulate what I want or even given myself permission. I mean, I did before my marriage, again, because I knew what I wanted then. But now that I'm trapped, in a sense, by these roles and my husband wanting me desperately to pursue whatever I wanted, he was so supportive and loving, but frustrated because I couldn't figure out what I wanted because I had these roles I was supposed to fill.
Well, and I felt the same way as a husband, to be honest. You know, you mentioned just going through the whole emotional crisis. On one hand, I truly believe, well, if we were just living the way we're supposed to, and if you could just stay at home and, you know, be able to do this or that, that would be great. But if you wanted to work too, that would be fine. But there was, this dissonance going on of, well, you know, maybe she should go back to work and have her career and go to school and, you know, because she needs to have her own identity. I think, you know, for us, it got to the point where when we started looking for outside help to try to help us work through this, because this was a hard time, especially through the church, we just kind of got this, well, pray, you know, have faith, things will work out.
I actually went to a church counselor, therapist, whatever they are, through LDS Social Services, and I distinctly remember, and I was at a very, very low point in my life, I went in there and I talked to him and he looked at me and he said, I don't know why you're here.
It's horrible. As a mental health professional, this story, I hate it. Yeah.
And it was just devastating to me. And I thought, well, my problems clearly don't matter.
Well, and so I saw in you, while we were in a sense of purpose return.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I think it was because all of a sudden you were physically helping people. And I think you identified at that point, it became clear to me that it wasn't.
Well, and I wasn't working. So this is really almost the first time, other than the first year of our first daughter's life, that I hadn't worked.
Right.
And so for me, well, I enjoyed staying home for a couple of years with our second daughter. It gave me a real sense of purpose that I was kind of lacking.
So when we moved, that went away. But what I found interesting is at that point, I think if I remember correctly, I sort of said, you can go to church. I think I'm going to take a little bit of a break.
Yes.
I think that only lasted for 2 or 3 weeks. But why did you want to go so bad? Because I know that for you, it was...
Knowing people. Like, how else was I supposed to make friends? I'm a person who it takes a while to get to know me, and it takes me a while to make friends. And so for me, it's that instant social connection.
I did never fit in socially at church because, you know, I was a theater major.
Doesn't know anything about
now
football.
Now I move over to fashion. I couldn't talk about sports if you wanted me to. I have nothing against it. Just it wasn't my interest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you go to Elder's Quorum and it was about the basketball game or football, and sometimes Katie would prep me before I would go. Just
give him scores.
Give me scores. But, you know, I wasn't finding any social value in going to church. And that was the other thing that kind of hit me.
Yeah.
Is that if I wasn't even finding social value out of it, Because I know my brothers, other friends that I have, some of them don't fully believe in the church, but they go because there's a camaraderie there.
Yeah.
And I will admit, it is nice to be able to have the church in every place you go. But, you know, at this point, when we needed help, we would go to friends and they wouldn't be in the church. And they were just as helping and loving as anyone else in the church. And so I ended up going, I guess, a few weeks in. You convinced me. But I remember the two issues that come pretty quick is, one, our oldest daughter turns 8.
Yes.
And I, at this point, felt like, I've always felt uncomfortable giving blessings and that sort of thing. Because I've always had this uncomfortable relationship with priesthood power. And what does that mean? One, because I've seen people who've been told that they're going to live and then they die. I've seen, you know, our friend's death that didn't make any sense. It seemed, on the one hand, very powerful and exciting and interesting, and on the other hand,
a farce.
And so it wasn't because I didn't feel worthy per se, it just that I didn't feel right baptizing my daughter. In the end I did, but I didn't confirm her.
We had a huge discussion about it, about him baptizing. He didn't want to, and I said, well, we have to do it. You know, how can we not do it? Because that would bring a whole host of problems that neither of us were willing to deal with at that
point. You were ready, yeah. No. It took four more years.
And I think you guys came up to the baptism and everything, and I think we even had a conversation like, I didn't even want to do this, but, you know, it's done. And I think still in my heart, I was like, well, at least she's baptized, so if I'm wrong, you know, at least she's saved. And I remember having that distinct feeling and thinking, I also kept thinking, well, if I am unworthy and I baptize my daughter, does that mean that it doesn't hold? So then I felt guilty about the fact that maybe her life would be in ruins because of mine. And then I thought, that's just ridiculous.
Well, especially because there was nothing, quote, unworthy except for a lack of belief.
You know,
none of us in this room have done any of the typical sins that are expected of people that go apostate.
Probably my worst problem is that I did everything I was supposed to, even when I doubted. I, you know, at that point, probably had never drunk anything alcoholic ever, never done any drugs, never touched a girl in a way that shouldn't be done. I mean, other than, you know, pre-marriage jitters and things like that, we went by the book. So that was hard. And then we ended up baptizing our second daughter.
Which I think was harder on both of us. At that point, it was 3 years later. And we both, I think, were having big issues about, and I felt kind of like, well, we'll leave it up to her if she makes the decision. But of course, what is she going to do? Say no?
Right.
So she was baptized.
And you're Relief Society, in the Relief Society presidency at this point. So you are very busy, but half liking it, but not. And so she did get baptized. I think what started to happen, though, is two things. One, I'm working in fashion and starting to even get more involved in sort of seeing different. I'm traveling. I've been to Asia at this point again and back to Europe quite a few times and studying my master's degree. And all of a sudden, I'm making some of these friends that are just amazingly intellectual people that are just, and that are kind, giving humanists. And I'm sitting here going, I'm going to church and we're talking about football. And then I'm going to school where we're supposed to, you know, it's too intellectual, quote unquote, for the church. And yet we're talking about how to help people in Africa. How do we make sure that we get jobs to America, you know, and all these issues, social issues that I care about. And I thought, well, why do I have to go to school to feel spiritually sort of full, and I'm going to church and I'm not? And I think we both sort of we put it on that metaphorical shelf at that point. I think both of us didn't want to talk about it. Katie every night would be like, so I don't know what your relationship is with God or the church, and can you just make a decision? And I was like, I don't want to talk about it.
And he wouldn't. I asked him for years. Like, I just wanted to know. I just wanted him to make a decision, tell me what he was going to do, and then I could deal with it and move on with my life. But he wasn't ready. I don't even know if I was really ready to hear it at that point. But I just wanted to know, because clearly we were both, and the thing is we would both look at each other after church and we were miserable and we knew it,
and
we
both
hated it.
And our kids were starting to be miserable too. The girls especially, because when you have two girls and they start going through the program, our oldest had just gotten the young women's.
Well, before that, they would come home and our oldest would say, well, we talked about this today, but you guys always say that, and it's the complete opposite of what she just learned at church. And we would have to try to explain how mommy and daddy have certain views and they aren't the same as the church. And she's like, well, how does that work? Mm-hmm. And I think it kind of forced us to start thinking, how does that work? Because clearly we have so many different views mm-hmm. that are in direct contrast.
Well, and there's a reality there at that point in time, because you had had a lot of emotional mm-hmm. issues about that. And it was like, why on earth would we set ourselves, our daughters up to have that same
yep. get them out
issue? Mm-hmm. And that scared you. We didn't. But the funny thing is we kind of talked about it cerebrally after church. We complained and that sort of thing. But it got to the point where church, we didn't like church. Mm-hmm. We just didn't like going, and we didn't like the people that were there. We felt like they were not helping us.
Well, the people were fine. It didn't feel real. It didn't feel organic. It just felt very much like everyone is going because that's what they were supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm.
No one really necessarily wanted to be there.
Right.
And I remember when you guys told us we'd come up to visit, and I remember you because what's interesting is that you had kind of a more long-term plan originally to leave the church mm-hmm. because there were some things going on in your extended family that you wanted to participate in, and then the next time we see you, it's like, no, we can't wait anymore. We're done.
Well, and I think this is worth saying because you and I end up having a lot of conversations uh-huh. about this because I think it just started with that book and mm-hmm. I knew we could talk. And so I was doing research for one of my, because I now teach. Mm-hmm. I teach in the city. And so I was doing some research on a topic that's near and dear to me, which is this idea of cultural modesty and clothing and what it means mm-hmm. to different people. And of course, it's very relative. And so I'm doing all of this research, and I thought, you know, it'd be really interesting to really look at where these modesty ideas came from mm-hmm. in the church. And lo and behold, I find a podcast called Mormon Expression talking about, I think it was nudity and naturism and that sort of thing. And I remember listening to it and thinking, okay, that's interesting. And then I was sitting on the beach, actually. I remember this. And the next one came on, and I'm listening to it. I thought, geez, this is such a fun discussion. Like, I wish we had these kind of discussions at church. Mm-hmm. And now we had these conversations before, you and I and your husband. But, you know, anyway, so I ended up sharing that with you. Mm-hmm. And I shared it with you, Katie, I think. Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first episode that you actually shared with me because I'm studying sexuality. And so one of the ones that you told me about was the one on the article about how to talk to your son-in-law about pornography, that horrible article. And I remember listening to that, and that was maybe a year ago at this point, and however many hours of Mormon Expression since then, I finally was able to leave.
And it was, you know, it's funny because it wasn't just Mormon Expression, but I think it was the conversation
yeah.
that was so valuable because I'd just been sort of saying, I can't talk about it. No mm-hmm. one else is going to understand. But I remember right around that time in the summer, this is right before you came, mm-hmm. Katie says, we're in bed, and she's like, so same question she'd been asking me for a couple of years. So what is your belief in God and the church? And I said, I have no belief in the church, mm-hmm. and I'm pretty sure I don't have a belief in God. And I remember thinking, crap, I just
said it.
I just may have ended a lot of things I didn't think. And she's like, me neither.
Well, no, I said, I believe in God.
Yeah.
But I don't believe in most of the things that the church teaches.
And that opened all of a sudden this, I would say, that's when you guys came. Mm-hmm. When we were telling you about this. And then you and I started having these massive Katie and I had these massive conversations over the course of like a month. Mm-hmm. And of course we had like you said, we had this big plan about how we were going to go to certain events, family mm-hmm. events, and then we were going to leave. But I actually didn't have my temple recommend at this point, and I had just decided I am not, mm-hmm. don't want anything to do with it. And I don't know, what made you think all of a sudden just, we're done?
I was teaching primary, and I was teaching these lessons, and I would read through the lessons, and I would think, oh my gosh, I can't teach them that. That's horrible. It's so shaming. That makes them feel guilty. That makes them seem like a terrible person. And these are 7-year-old children. Mm-hmm. that don't need to be shamed and guilted. And so I found that I couldn't teach most of the lesson. So I would pick like one thing out of the whole lesson, like love or kindness, being kind to others, or, you know, just something like that. And I specifically remember one lesson was about sheep.
And I thought, remember this.
Oh my gosh, that is what I'm teaching them to be.
It was on sheep.
Yeah.
Oh, being like a to follow.
Yes.
Oh, got it.
But I mean, they use specifically sheep, and I thought, I cannot continue in good conscience to teach these children principles that I believe, not only do I not believe that they're true, but I believe that they're detrimental to their development. Mm-hmm. And so it just got to a point where I said, I can't keep doing this. I cannot keep teaching this. And I'm not going to continue living something that I feel is not true for months in order to go to an event. I just can't do it anymore. I feel like I'm living a lie. Mm-hmm. And I just needed to get it off my chest because I just felt so terrible about it. And I prayed about leaving the church, which sounds really weird. but I did. And I felt so good about it and got such a peaceful feeling, mm-hmm. which, you know, is clearly what you're supposed to feel when you get an answer from God. And I just felt like this is the right thing. And I felt also like for my kids, and this drove me nuts, actually. This was the thing that bothered me most about when we told family that we were leaving the church. The question I got the most, or that we got the most, was, what about your girls? I wanted to be like, what about my girls? They're the reason I'm leaving. I'm leaving to save my kids mm-hmm. from the pain and suffering and guilt and shame and all those horrible things that I suffered from.
Well, and continue to suffer from.
Right.
Like, I think that's the thing that's a struggle with these things, is I finally feel some sense of liberation from that heavy weight, but it's going to be many years mm-hmm. to come for me to try to shed that level of internal shame that took me, you know, 36 years to have indoctrinated into me. And now I am slowly trying to peel it away. And if we can prevent that from happening for the next generation, I think, what a gift, you know, like helping them to take the good things that we still think were beneficial from the church and take it with us, but shed it of all of this shame that is not healthy.
Contradiction.
And, but just, I look at my little boys and worry. They're boys, so they may not get the same level of shaming, but I worry about their future, and hope that my transition out of the church can help them know that there's another way of looking at things.
Well, what happened that spring? Because I think that sort of shifted the conversation.
No, it was about 3.5 years ago. I don't have quite as many of those issues, the lingering guilt and such as Kim, because about 3.5 years ago, I have a lot of good friends. Most of my good friends where we live now are not Mormon. So they always give up something for Lent. And so one friend was telling me she'd given up coffee for Lent, and another friend it was chocolate or something. And I was thinking about that, and I think I even said to Josh, I said, I'm giving up guilt for Lent.
I love it. It's brilliant.
And so I decided that I was no longer going to feel guilty about all the things I should be doing, and that I was just going to try to be a good person, and I was not going to feel guilty about it. And so I gave up guilt and
for Lent,
Lent and beyond.
I never looked beyond
and
go back.
It changed my life. It changed how I viewed things. It changed how I viewed me. I was happier. I no longer cared what the church said I should and shouldn't be doing, as long as I felt like I was doing the best that I could do in being a good person. And I just, and I mean, not that I never felt guilty, but I
and
don't
have... And that's okay. A little dose of guilt is healthy, but...
I don't have that same sense of guilt and shame that I carried for so many years. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I think that allowed me to finally leave the church.
And that, I think, was the hardest part for us, because when we did finally decide to go, I mean, the short part of the story is we went and told our bishop we chose.
Yeah.
And we sat down with him and we said, we're just going to let you know. And he was the nicest guy in the world.
Told him we need to be released.
We said, we need to be released. We're going to be leaving the church. And we actually have one more week because we want to be here for Christmas, because I was playing,
the Christmas program.
And after that, we won't be coming back. And he said, okay. And he asked us
Yeah, so some questions.
A couple of questions, and sort of what we expected from the church. And we said nothing, and we asked that you be very respectful of that, and he has been. But, you know, then telling parents is a very difficult situation. But I think for us, the thing that's been the hardest, because everything else after we got through sort of that initial couple of weeks of telling family, was that nobody really understood how much better we felt.
Yeah.
Like, literally, it was...
Because they all felt so bad.
We're so excited, and we feel so relieved and liberated. And we just wanted them to understand, because we knew they couldn't, but at least understand how happy we felt for the first time in a long time. And they don't.
Well, and it's devastating to feel so happy when you know that you devastated some of the closest people to you. And that was really hard. Really, really hard.
Mm-hmm. And continues to be, because I think that's never going to change.
Right.
I know for, well, just my family was devastated, and they've been lovely and respectful, but that sheer devastation that they experienced, you know, won't change because you have rejected the things that they hold near and dear. And it comes back to, and they don't understand, because they have a paradigm of thinking about what apostasy is, and we don't fit that. And so when we say, no, we're truly happier than we've ever been, they can't comprehend that, because that's not how it's supposed to work. Happiness is only supposed to be found through the Lord's church.
Right.
And I think that's a struggle of understanding of, like, no, I feel better than I've ever felt inside my internal self.
Right.
Like, I just think for me, it's this internal stuff going on inside of me. And although I have a journey ahead of me to heal some of the things, I think my internal recording that goes on is such a healthier place.
Well, I found, you know, I told my father and had meant to tell my mom soon thereafter, but he told her first, and she wrote me an email. And a couple of things. One, and I don't want to get too personal, but, you know, part that hurt me about her email wasn't that she thought it was her fault.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the whole reason why I finally left the church is because I didn't want that guilt. I didn't want those restrictions that just didn't make sense to me. And I remember writing her back, because it's very hard to write these letters.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the one that probably, I wrote it in 10 minutes, I think, because it just was so easy to say, actually, instead of trying to explain everything to you, I'm just going to thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for giving me all of those diverse experiences and letting me travel and getting me involved in music and theater, because that's what made me, all of those experiences, which, you know, we could take hours and hours to explain. It's all of those multitude of diverse experiences and living in places that I've lived to realize that there are so many wonderful people out there, that there's no one truth. There might be, at least in my mind, truth to me is being true to other people.
Mm-hmm.
I really subscribe to that, you know, humanist ethic idea. And I wrote that back to her and said, you know, thank you, because it's really you who made me who I am and gave me the courage to follow through. And sadly, we've never had a conversation about the church since, but at the same time, I feel like there's nothing a whole lot more I can say, because that's how I feel.
And I think that's, again, I don't want to go into talking in detail about my family, but I think my mother's response was very similar in how devastated she was, but that she took it on herself.
Yeah.
Here I am, I've not lived in her home for almost 20 years, and somehow this is her fault.
Mm-hmm.
That if she had taught her values to me better, that I wouldn't be making this choice. And so by me making this choice reflects poorly on her mothering. And I think, what a tragedy, because she was an amazing mother. I had an idyllic childhood, and she pushed me to be me. And I think, beautiful. And instead of it being this wonderful opportunity to embrace your child making a choice that makes them happy and gives them fulfillment, she has been given this paradigm of thinking where she blames herself for a choice, and she sees it as a devastating choice. And I just think it just breaks my heart that she feels so much pain for a decision that's brought me so much joy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
Yep.
It breaks my heart, and I feel horrible about that, but You know what? I think this is a conversation I had the other day with a family member of, I have gotten to the point that I cannot live my life for anyone else. I have to live my life for me. And I have to be okay with the fact that my decisions might hurt somebody, and I'll be empathetic and understanding, but it's my life and I have to be okay with me living it for me. And I think that's a really hard decision, but it's a powerful, important one.
I would agree. I feel like we should end there, but I feel like there's one more mm-hmm. thing. Joshua and I clearly left the church together. We had months worth of discussions and mm-hmm. we talked about so many things, and finally we're able to kind of open up to each other about this, which is hilarious because we talk about everything to exhaustion, I feel like, sometimes, but church was one thing we did not talk about. And we finally were able to talk about that and leave together. And it was a joint decision that we made. Mm-hmm. I mean, that we both felt really good about. But clearly, Kim, you are still, you're in a relationship with someone who is still an active member mm-hmm. of the church. And so that is very different, clearly, mm-hmm. than what our experience yeah. is.
Well, and I will say I am very lucky because, one, going into our marriage, my husband understood that I was already on shaky ground with Mormonism. And so he understood that this was maybe some, I mean, I told him, I said, I can't promise I'll always be Mormon. So he had that heads up long ago. although then he had, you know, 8 years of me being very active, but, I mean, he's an amazing person and I really appreciate his perspective on the church. And I think his perspective on the church allowed me to semi-comfortably stay in it for a lot longer. Is he's a big believer in the concept of the plan of salvation, not necessarily in the dogma that's thrown in about the plan of salvation, but the core concept that be better today than you were yesterday, continue learning and growing. And for him, the church still provides an opportunity for that. And I think when I get nervous about my children being indoctrinated with stuff that was shaming and horrible for me, I get hope that their example is him, because he has such a healthy relationship with Mormonism and such a healthy perspective on it, I think. And I think I've used the word healthy like 8,000 times in the past few minutes, but I think he also loves, because we're back in that environment of a very diverse board, and he loves the opportunity that it gives him a chance to be friends and associate with people he wouldn't know in another context. Mm-hmm. And I like that about him too. And I think because it's not a source of conflict for us, I mean, I think you guys asked him last night and his answer was, well, I don't really think anything's changed. So in our marriage, things are very much still similar. I go to sacrament with my family to support my children and to support him. And then I leave and I go to a different congregation and I go spend time with the ethical humanists and get that balance on my Sunday. And I think it's working for us. I don't know how long that, if it will ever change or shift, or, but for now it works. And I think he's a really good example of how this can still work. It doesn't have to be a break in the marriage. And I think part of that, though, is because we were married much older. We had a lot more sense of what we wanted, and we didn't marry because we were Mormon. We married because we really like each other and we really like our personalities and really like spending time. And so I think that's part of why it still works. Right. But
so just, I think, to wrap this up, I think we're hitting a good point here.
Are we going to list our vices now?
What we do now, post-mortem?
I was going to say, I think it's just really interesting. Maybe we just kind of say where we are at this point.
Well, I know the voices often end with, what are your beliefs?
Yeah.
So maybe we just go around and say, okay.
So at this point in time, I don't even really like labels that much. Mm-hmm. I think what I would say is that ultimately, I believe that that again, truth is sort of the idea of treating each other well and, mm-hmm. and believing in humankind. And I don't really believe in a God or a Jesus or that or a plan mm-hmm. of salvation. And for me, you know, it's been very freeing, but it's also forced me to sort of reevaluate my whole entire life. Mm-hmm. Because one thing I didn't mention in this is that I was always taught that if I tried hard enough and prayed hard enough mm-hmm. and was good enough, that I would succeed and be successful. And I can tell you today that I didn't reach some of the goals I had in my life, and I blamed the fact that maybe I wasn't good enough or hadn't done it right. And you take all that away, and now what do you have left? Just you.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and there's, you win some, you lose some. Sometimes it's luck, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's somebody else's decision that affects mine. And so, for me, it's just trying to live a better life. And for me, with our family, I think it's sort of reconstructing, which we were really worried about. At the very beginning, we thought, okay, we're going to start studying Buddhism and philosophy, and we're going to do it every week. And we did for a while, and I think it was great for the girls.
2 weeks. Yeah. 2 weeks. We did a good job.
I made it sound better. But, at the end of the day, having that Sunday as a family day, which is what we've done, has changed our lives. It's absolutely the most best day we have, even if we do nothing but watch TV, because we never did that. We always were too busy with our careers and
church obligations
and activities. And now we just sit around on a Sunday and we enjoy each other. And so for us, it's, my belief is in people, and my belief is that, and my struggle now is trying to kind of re-compartmentalize a little bit, or maybe that's the wrong word, but restructure how I want to move forward. But it's the first time I felt really happy about it, or content. Not happy, I think, is a little tricky, but I feel like, hey, I don't have to worry. Just got to get through the next day.
Yeah.
And that was one thing, by the way, you used to say all the time to me, and which we didn't mention, Katie, which is, she was always afraid of the celestial kingdom. Like, I don't want to go there.
I hate it.
She couldn't stand it. And I always loved that, because at least there was something you're working towards. And I finally realized that's all I was doing, is working towards a goal that was completely intangible to me and I didn't even understand it. And now I'm working towards tangible goals. And I think, so that's where I am.
Well, I still believe in God, a relationship that is continually evolving. I also just, my basic belief system is being a good person and teaching my children to be kind, loving, self-sufficient adults who want to make the world a better place. And that's pretty much how I feel.
Mine also continues to evolve. There's still some, I don't believe in Jesus Christ as a Messiah, but there are things that get attributed to him. Now, whether it was him or not, the Sermon on the Mount and other things, the idea of social justice and fighting for social justice still resonate with me. And so I'm still trying to figure out what I think about that and what I feel. But again, I don't see him as a divine being. And is there a divine being? I don't know. And I don't need to know. I am now at a place in my life where I'm really comfortable in the not knowing. And like Josh mentioned, dealing with tangible things, I feel so much more comfortable focusing on living a good life and not worrying about anything else. And if there's an afterlife, great. What a wonderful surprise. And if there's not, then I haven't wasted my life focusing on something that, instead, I can just appreciate the moments for today. For now, I've found a sense of community in the Ethical Humanist Society, and I just wanted to read one thing of theirs, because it struck me my first Sunday there, is that in their synopsis they say that they honor the worth of every individual, nurturing human relationships and ethical community, and build social justice. And the first program I heard was all about social justice issues and what, as a community, they are doing to help in their community create more social justice. And that just resonated with me so much. And so for now, I'm finding a home there, and I'm figuring out what I want to do. But I'm okay in the ambiguity, and I think that that's the nice part of being at the stage that we're in.
Amen.
Yeah, well, thank you for asking us to do this, Kim.
Sure.
And letting go has not been easy. But I don't need you loving me for who you think I should be. No, I'm standing here at the end of who I once was. Not sure yet. I'm
Directing, producing, and editing was done by Heather C., and the theme music was provided by McCall Erickson. Thank you for listening. Mormon Expression Voices is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Find us on the web at whitefieldseducational.org. The Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices podcasts, as well as other educational initiatives, are made possible by your generous donations. Please consider a subscription today.